Okay, thank you for the opportunity. And of course, it's very hard to beat the excitement of the announcement of the change of leadership. And so in comparison, I'll be talking about something extremely boring, standard model. But I should also say that it's all based on this paper that I put on the archive about a year ago. And I should kind of make a small disclaimer. I should say that almost everything I say in this talk has been known for quite a long time to various people, to some people. So the novelty here is really in putting these things together and also in the idea that the mathematics I'm talking about may be of relevance for the standard model. But the facts I'm basing my discussion on are old and relatively known. Okay. So we're talking about standard model here. Nature is accurately described by the standard model. And of course, the status of the standard model is that standard model together with gravity extended in, well, extended by adding right-handed neutrinos and with very simple or very natural assumptions, one can say, well, the nature of inflation, dark matter, and dark energy explains almost everything, almost every observation that we make about our universe. But standard model is seemingly a mess, devoid of any structure. And so in that sense, it seems like an approximation to something else, to some other likely more symmetric theory. Still, closer inspection reveals that hidden structure is there. And of course, it's very important to understand what structure, the standard, what kind of clue standard model suggests. Because these clues may eventually lead, may one day lead to finding a more fundamental description. And well, researchers were after the hidden structure within the standard model almost from the time it was discovered itself. And so several grand unification schemes have been proposed. The most famous, two of them, the SU5 unification scheme by Georgi Glashow and SU2, SU2, SU4, theory of Patti Salam. You see, the years are 70s. These are, of course, the years when the standard model itself was discovered. So almost immediately after the formulation of the standard model, grand unification schemes were proposed. Both of these schemes are unified within the SO10 grand unified scheme. And this is the most elegant proposal. It describes all fermions of a single generation of standard model as a single complex while irreducible representation of 16C, well, of dimension 16. And I will expand on this. I will remind you how the SO10 good works. But even though this unification scheme is there, it actually poses more questions than it answers. Because one can, once one understands that SO10 plays some role, one can go down to the standard model by sequence of symmetry breakings, carefully arranged not to conflict the experiment. But one simply arranges the symmetry breakings in a way that reproduces the answer known, namely the standard model. There is really no explanation why the standard model arises, why it's this particular symmetry breaking pattern and not some other. So there is no convincing explanation or no convincing answer to the question why standard model. There are, of course, other attempts apart from grand unification to understand the structure of the standard model, notably non-commutative geometry is such an attempt. I will not talk about it here, even though what I'm saying is not completely unrelated. But I'm happy to talk about that in private, but no, this is not the subject of the talk. Still, it seems that SO10 pattern of the standard model fermions holds some important truths in it. And so let me remind you how this all arises. So let's start by reviewing the spinor Lagrangian. This is, we are in four dimensions, the usual fermion or the usual spinors. Remember that spinors are representations of the Lorentz group. There are two irreducible representations. I'll call them unprimed primed. Well, this is a notation. Of course, the prime spinor is the complex conjugate of unprimed. So they are Hermitian conjugates of each other. And it's it will be convenient when I talk about standard model fermions to think about two-component spinners, not four-component spinners. So people who have studied the standard model usually, but of course not always, there are textbooks which do two components, but usually this is four-component. So there may be some novelty in the notation here, but I hope people will still be able to follow. So let's start with a very basic thing, the Weyl Lagrangian. This is a Lagrangian that you can write for single two-component spinner. Well, and it's the spinner chi A. This is the Dirac operator, and then you multiply with the Hermitian conjugate of the same spinner. So this is, it's not manifestly real, but it's actually real moduli surface term. By integration by parts, one can show that this is real. So in principle, one could have added a complex conjugate, but this is not necessary. And it's also very often useful to have index-free notation in which you suppress the spinner indices, two-component spinner indices, then you write something like this. So this is just a single two-component spinner, and standard model is built from many of those, and also adding appropriate mass terms. So let's review that. This is the content of the standard model. In this table, every field here is a two-component spinner. And spinners come kind of, well, in the four-component notation, the spinner U would be paired with U bar. This guy, U bar, is, it's not to be confused with complex conjugation. This is just a name. And so, what's the right way of thinking? Of course, these are the quarks. They transform under SU2. They have color. And these are the left-handed quarks. They transform under SU2 as well. They are the doublet under SU2. There is also a pair of fields describing quarks, but these do not transform under SU2. They are right-handed. They also transform under SU3, because they are quarks. There is also the Y here is the representation of U1. The U1 electric charge, but of course this is not the U1 that becomes eventually the U1, the unbroken U1. The unbroken U1 charge is a combination of Y and T3. And there are also leptons. There are left-handed leptons which transform under SU2. And in standard model, there is just one right-handed lepton. So in the usual standard model, right-handed neutrino is not part of it. So if you want, this guy is the electron. It's better not to say that. Yeah, but okay, so these are 15, counting the color, these are 15 two-component spinners. If you add the right-handed neutrino, one obtains 16 two-component spinners. As I said, in this table, they are all the unprime spinners, but of course, standard model. Well, including the color. So let's count. This is 2 times 3, yeah, including the color, yeah. Okay, of course, there are also 3 generations, but generations will not matter for us in this talk. I'll just talk about one generation. And okay, the next step is the standard model Lagrangian. It's a relatively long expression, especially if you write it in terms of two-component spinners. So it's better to say it in words than write. So every of these two-component spinners will have its Weyl kinetic term, which is that. You just write spinner, complex conjugate spinner, Dirac operator between them. They're all coupled to these gauge fields. And the coupling is clear because they transform with respect to those gauge groups. So coupling, you just extend the derivative operator with the gauge field and couple it in this way. There is also the Higgs field, which is a complex valued SU2 doublet of hypercharge half. And then you just write all possible terms of mass dimension 4 that are compatible with the gauge and Lorentz symmetry together with their Hermitian conjugates. Plus you add kinetic terms for the gauge fields, usual F squared. Plus you add the kinetic plus potential term for the Higgs. And potential is quartic, which makes Higgs acquire a non-trivial F. It's a good idea to add right-handed sterile neutrinos. This is the 16th two-component spinner to the standard model. It can be added for free because it's sterile. It doesn't interact with anyone. But if you do this, then a mass term for them becomes possible. And if this mass term is large, then this gives you an explanation why the masses of all other fermions are small. There is some nice mechanism of this sort that is possible. So from now on, my standard model will be this, with the right-handed neutrino. So it will involve 16 two-component spinners and their complex conjugates. Now let's try to understand the SO10 structure. The way to get to SO10 is to think about leptons as the fourth color of quarks. So we simply say that nu L, neutrino electron, is just U and D up and down quark, but of a fourth color. Then we'll have an SU4 mixing the four colors of quarks. Of course, it will be it is broken in the Lagrangian of the standard model, but we think about this as a possible symmetry to add to get into more symmetric phase of the standard model. And then we also add the new gauge symmetry, which mixes up right-handed spinners. So we form doublets from the up-down quark. We form this doublet. We form the doublet with the right-handed neutrino and the right-handed electron. And so these two-component spinners are also arranged into fundamental representation of SU4. SU4 mixes them up as well. So the representations we get, or rather we put all the particles in these representations of SU2, SU2, SU4. We have a single kind of quark field, which has four colors. This is the four, this fundamental representation of SU4. And it's also the fundamental representation of the first SU2. And then we have the barred field, which is untimed fundamental representation of SU4 and the fundamental representation of this SU2. And well, there are 8 two-component spinners here. There are 8 two-component spinners there. One then notes that SU2 cos SU2 is basically SO4, and SU4 is basically SO6. And therefore, they naturally sit inside SO10 in this way. And then one also notices the following representation theory fact. If you have a Weyl spinner representation of SO2n, remember that even dimension orthogonal groups, they are spinner representation is reducible, and the irreducible representations are called Weyl spinners, or half spin representations sometimes. So they have dimension twice less than the dimension of the full spinner representation in this dimension. And so if you take a Weyl spinner and restrict it to SO2k mod SO2n minus k, so still even dimensional orthogonal groups embedded just diagonally into SO2n in the standard way as kind of blocks sitting on the diagonal, then this Weyl spinner representation splits as Weyl spinner of both of these groups plus another Weyl spinner of both of them of opposite chiralities. Because, well, this guy has a Weyl spinner, but it also has a Weyl spinner representation of opposite chirality, and so does this. And you get tensor product of these two plus tensor product of Weyl spinners of opposite chiralities. And actually, this is what we have here, precisely. Because this is, well, this is the Weyl representation. So we have, I think it's explained here. The groups that we have here is SO4, SO6. The Weyl representation of SO4 of one chirality is just this 2-1 representation. The vowel representation of the opposite chirality is 1-2. And then the vowel representations of SO4 is a 4-dimensional fundamental representation. So this pattern of representations just follows this description of decomposition of vowel representation into irreducibles. So again, if we take single 16-dimensional irreducible vowel representation of SO10 and restrict it to SO4 cross SO6, we will just get this pattern of particles. So this is why standard model fermions so naturally fit into SO10. So what we have so far is that two component spinners, of which there is 16, they form this 16C. And of course, there is also the complex conjugates of them in the standard model. Okay. Then let's go back to the main story, which is, so we are approaching SO77, and the idea is that, so in the description of SO10 unification, Lorentz spinner in this has played no role. We simply, everybody that we put together into 16-dimensional representation of SO10 was a two-component spinner, but that two-component spinner index played no role. So at the moment, what we have is that we have a field which has a two-component spinner index, and the 16-component spinner index of SO10, right? So all the fermions of the spinners, of the two-component spinners of the standard model have been unified in this field. It's still a two-component spinner from the point of view of Lorentz group. But we haven't done anything to this index. And plus, there is a complex conjugate of this field. And just by counting how many real functions there are, so we have 16 two-component spinners. Every two-component spinner is a two complex functions. So we have 32 complex functions in one generation of the standard model, or 64 real valued functions I needed to encode all the fermions. Okay, but now we can repeat the trick. The trick is this. Whenever you have products of vowel representations plus the products of vowels of opposite chirality, and this is what we have here. This is vowel representation times vowel representation, but its complex conjugate is just products of vowel representations of opposite chiralities. So we can again apply this construction and realize that all these spinner, all of these components can be put together into a bigger vowel representation. So we just need to put we need to put Lorentz group together with the good group SO10 into group whose complexification is SO14C. And at the moment, I write complexification because I don't want to worry about reality yet. I'll worry about it on the next slide. So at the moment, what we have is that if we take 64-dimensional vowel representation of SO14, we know that on restricting to SO4 times SO10, the 64-dimensional representation will split into vial of SO4 times vial of this plus another vial of SO4 times another vial of this. So this is just representation theory. But then to make this idea, fix this idea, we need to select an appropriate real form. And let's talk about the possible real forms for this SO14C. So what we know is that from the previous count, we want to have 64 real functions. We don't want to have 64 complex functions. This tells us that we want a real 64-dimensional vowel representation. Not a complex 64-dimensional vowel representation, but this happens very rarely. Typically, vowel representations of orthogonal groups are not real. And the condition for it to be real is that the signature, the difference between number of pluses and number of minuses in the metric, should be 0 mod 8. And then there are just two possibilities, SO77 and SO113. So for both of them, the vowel representation is real. And both of them will contain what we want, namely, they will contain Lorentz group times the Patti-Salam group as subgroups. They contain this in a different way. So the SO113 possibility contains actually the SO10. What commutes with Lorentz group inside is SO10. The possibility SO77, what commutes with Lorentz group, is actually a non-compact group SO64. But its maximally compact part is a Patti-Salam. So that's good enough. Well, Patti-Salam is a subgroup of this group as well.
So when you say it's good enough, you don't have SO10 there.
You don't have SO10 there, no.
So what do you mean by it's good enough?
It's good enough in the sense that you have the Patti-Salam group there. And all we know is that particles of the standard model do transform on the Patti-Salam.
So the SO10 was the element.
Well, in this particular, yeah, in this particular possibility, SO10 is not a symmetry. It's not a subgroup.
For either SO10 or for SO6, for a single generation fermion, you find the spinner of that group, single.
Well, it will if we start writing something, but I'm not writing any kinetic terms here. Yeah, I will discuss this, of course. At the moment, this is just, at the moment, yeah, usually this is excluded because whenever we do grand unification theory, we'll be writing Jan-Mills Lagrangian for these fields. And of course, Jan-Mills Lagrangian for these fields would be bad.
So you're not going to do that?
I'm not going to do this. Well, and the reason why I'm not going to do this is that this is not so much different from this, and I'm not going to write Jan-Mills Lagrangian for this, right? So I'm actually, well, we're putting together the good group with the Lorentz group. So it would be stupid to write Jan-Mills Lagrangians for them. And well, therefore.
So what's the idea behind the unification? What kind of
There is no Lagrangian. No, I'm not proposing any Lagrangian. I'm describing facts from representation theory. But, well, so the hope is that these facts are, well, let me carry on. It will become clear why this may be interesting. So this talk is advertisement of this option. The mathematics that comes with this option is really interesting. And I want to tell you what.
Sorry, and the fact that these are the only two possibilities, where you could have SO31, SO64, I mean, the other one doesn't work?
Which ones? Well, you're supposed to get
this one where you get 94 or something, SO94.
Then there will be no Patti-Salam inside. So that is not good.
No, if you put SO31 times
SO64. That doesn't work because.
Instead of SO13.
Well, but then you don't get SO77, right?
No, you get SO.
That doesn't work.
SO9.
Yeah, that doesn't work because the signature is not 0 mod 8. Okay. So the vowel is complex in that case. So that simply doesn't work.
Okay.
So both of these groups, they contain Lorentz and the Patti-Salam gauge group inside. And representation theory works out correctly in the sense I described. This is clear. But there is even more that can be said. If you take...
Just a question about what is the constraints on groups? Patti-Salam is passed through the constraints?
Well, it's possible to write models with SO10 but I'm not writing any models either. So I'm not doing physics with this. I'm just doing representation theory. Okay. And actually, I don't know how to write. That you have to ask somebody else. As far as I know, SO10, you can arrange the pattern of symmetry breaking such that it passes all the constraints. But There are lots of parameters. There are many ways of doing it. But well, yeah, one can write models based on SO10, which pass all the constraints. Okay, let me carry on. So another statement that can be made is that if we take this vial spinner of SO14 and write the vial Lagrangian for it in 14 dimensions, we can dimensionally reduce that down to 4D simply by assuming that components of this vial spinner do not depend on the other coordinates. And again, one can check that this reproduces the correct vial Lagrangians, the correct kinetic terms for all the spinners. This is not surprising. This is just a statement that Dirac operator, when you dimensionally reduce it, gives you Dirac operators. This fact is not at all surprising, but it can be checked by explicit calculation. And actually, the exercise that is done in my paper is just checking that this indeed explicitly I verify that this is happening. But this fact is not surprising. The fact of dimensional reduction. The fact of dimensional reduction reproducing the Lagrangian for the spinners in 4D exactly as you want.
Does dimensional reduction 4D split that up into the Patti-Salam, or does it split it up?
It's split in Patti-Salam, yeah, of course.
So
yeah, it does not split it all the way to the standard model because, yeah, there is no explanation of why it's SU3. You just reproduce Patti-Salam, of course.
As long as I'm interrupting anyone, could I just interrupt with one comment about Bronson? So the experimental status, if you write down Brain Integration as a Yang Mills theory in 4D, then the status is that SO10 is alive. Non-supersymmetric SO10 is still alive. There's two possible breaking patterns, one through SU5, that one is dead. But the other one goes through Patti-Salam, and that one is alive.
OK, so everything I said so far is a representation theory of the type that has been known to people. In fact, well, there is some literature on this unification scheme, well, on this representation theory inspired unification scheme. So Perkachi in the past has considered 11-3 scheme. More recently, Chamsidin Mukhanov considered 13-1. The choice of 13-1 was dictated by the fact that they want to have SO, well, not just SO10 inside, they want to have just one time, right? This gauge group is the one with one time direction. So they were motivated by that. They considered this. But of course, then there is fermion doubling, which they are concerned about. They suggest some way of resolving it. But the problem is there. This group leads you to the problem of fermion doubling. And so why is this idea, as I said, this idea has been around for many years. So why is it not universally known? Why is it not as well known as SO10 idea? And of course, the reason is that one cannot write any reasonable Lagrangian with this idea. The problem is that we can easily couple this Dirac or this vial Lagrangian to gauge fields, to SO14 gauge fields. This is easy. And then we would need to write some Lagrangian for these gauge fields. But we cannot write Yang-Mills Lagrangian for them. Because there is this generalized frame around in their story, yes.
So they do have a very...
Well, they have more concrete proposal, yes. But then, well, their proposal suffers from this fermion doubling problem.
Well, can their proposal be adapted to the other schemes? Really,
well,
their proposal is very universal.
But also, they don't do this. Their proposal is to start in four dimensions. Their theory is four-dimensional. They enlarge the internal space, but they don't enlarge. So, for example, they wouldn't write, as I'm suggesting here, via Lagrangian in 14 dimensions, and then dimensionally reduce. This is not what they're doing. Maybe it can be adapted, but still, I don't believe that there is any natural dynamical principle that you can write based on this proposal. If there was one, I think we would know about it. And so, well, this idea of writing just this Lagrangian, coupling it to gauge fields, and then writing Jan-Mills for this gauge field is not good, clearly, because, well, part of this connection is the spin connection of gravity. We don't try it.
But at the end of the day, when you quickly dimension here, you use index I, it's going to be 1 to 4, right?
This one, yes, it's going to be. Yes, yes, yes.
And that's exactly what you kind of chips in the proposal. That you can only take derivative on 4, even if you
have. Well, so yes.
It's like the work already dimensionally reduced. So you don't have to dimensionally reduce.
Okay, this is one option. One option is not to dimensionally reduce and just write such a theory in four dimensions and try to propose dynamical principle. Again, the principle that they write is reasonable, but it's not convincing. So there is nothing completely, well, simple in this scheme that convinces you immediately you see it. There is no such dynamical principle. And so the difficulty here, why this scheme is not so popular and not so known as it would have been, is that we're trying to unify here the spin connection of gravity or the Lorentz group with the grand unification group. And so what we're trying to do is to unify gravity with other interactions. And of course, this is very difficult. Or, well, there is no good known way of doing this. But still, standard model fermions, just the pattern of standard model fermions, suggest that this unification takes place in some way. Right? This is actually one of the hints that gravity is unified with gauge theory, just from the pattern of standard model fermions. And yes?
Dimensional reduction, mm-hmm. You just do it on a torus?
No, you just do it. You just simply assume that fields do not depend on some of the coordinates. That's essentially, don't even compactify. It's very naive dimensional reduction. You just say that fields do not depend on 10 of the 14 coordinates and just depend on 4. And after that, you work out what happens. You find that just the right kinetic terms of Patti-Salam fermions appear.
But then you are exactly, if you do that, you're exactly in this general geometry.
Maybe.
Where the bundle dimension
maybe.
Is bigger than the space dimension. So
maybe.
What you could do is just postulate that from the beginning, the get-go, right? Just extend the bundle and not extend the weight.
That's what Pukhanov and Chomsky
mean. Yeah.
And I was wondering whether this, you just did that with this.
Yeah.
Or it might give something.
Yeah. This is also generalized geometry.
Well,
so it's
maybe.
Very natural.
But, okay, let me just carry on. Okay, so the next part of the talk is to tell you that actually SO14 is a very special group. So there is some exceptional, SO14 is really a very, very special orthogonal group. Some exceptional phenomena are happening for it. So there again may be some clues in the exceptional character of SO14. Let me talk about that. So one representation theory fact is that you can start comparing dimension of the group itself, which is that, and dimension of its Weyl representation, which is that. And as you see with n, dimension of the Weyl representation grows exponentially, dimension of the group grows just quadratically. And so it's clear that for sufficiently small n's, we have dimension of the group. The group is bigger than the Weyl representation. But for sufficiently large n, spin representation is bigger. And one representation theory fact is that the last n when group is bigger than its Weyl representation is exactly SO14. N is equal to 7. So let's verify this. For n equals 7, the dimension of the group is 91. Dimension of the Weyl is 64. The next SO16 is 120, dimension of Weyl is 128. So why is it good to have dimension of the group bigger than dimension of Weyl? Because then it will act, it will slice your Weyl spinner representation into orbits, and point on the orbit will have a non-trivial stabilizer, simply because group is bigger than the space where it acts, there will be a stabilizer. It's good to have stabilizers because this is symmetry breaking of some sort. So this is already interesting. But another reason why it's good to be in this situation is that there is typically, well, if you take the group smaller than dimension of than the Weyl representation, there are many different types of spinners, there are many different types of orbits. While for this situation, there is typically kind of one generic orbit, which is good. And also the stabilizer, it's good to have a stabilizer because it will define some geometric structure in the space, as I'll explain. And this geometric structure is very interesting for SO77. So the other representation theory fact is that dimension of the generic orbit for SO77 is 63. One cannot, it turns out that one cannot change the scale of the spinner in this case. And then just by counting, one takes dimension of the group minus dimension of the orbit. One expects the stabilizer to be 28 dimensional. Well, and this suggests that it's related to in some way to G2. And so, well, in fact, it's a fact. There are three types of generic orbits for this. So now I'm talking about SO77. There are three types of generic orbits. The stabilizer in one case is G2 times G2 compact real form. There is also G2 cross G2 split real form. And the last case is G2 complexified. So all these types of orbits do happen. Why is this interesting? Because, well, with stabilizer groups being related to G2, one can show that these signals that a Weyl spinner defines another second metric in R77. And this is what is most exceptional about this SO77 situation. So generic Weyl spinner, generic non-zero Weyl spinner defines the second metric in the space R77. The way the second metric arises is that the stabilizer subgroup is smaller, but is contained in the subgroup that commutes with matrices. So one has matrices, endomorphisms of R77, either square into 1 or square into minus 1. This is case 1, 1 prime, case 2. This endomorphism is compatible with the split signature metric, and so it's of this form necessarily. And then, G is a metric in 7 dimensions, and B is a 2 form in 7 dimensions. And then lowering the index of this endomorphism with the metric, with the split signature metric in R77, one gets the second metric in R77. So here.
Usually, the isometric group of I squared plus 1 is 0.7 times
0.7. Yes, it reduces further. The group. The further reduction is that the spinner does not just define such an endomorphism, it also defines two SO7 spinners in 7 dimensions. So this is why there is a further reduction to G2 cos G2. So the spinner of SO77 defines this guy, so G and B in 7 dimensions, as well as two unit spinners. In 7 dimensions, yeah. But that's the origin of the further reduction.
Okay. And do they have special spinners or pure spinners?
No, they're generic. No, they're not pure. They're generic, yeah.
If this is related to, there's this as you go, there are these manifolds of special Polanyi, like Kähler, and then there's.
Okay, yeah, this.
Kähler is associated with the Quaternions, and 70, there's these.
Yeah, that is related to that story because, of course, a spin. Three form in 7 dimensions defines a spinner as well as a metric. And so the exceptional holonomy story fits into that scheme. Yeah, so it's all related. If you want, this story becomes a generalized exceptional holonomy. So actually, this type of setup has been analyzed by Hitchin in the context of generalized geometry. Yeah, so there is a link to generalized geometry, and indeed in generalized geometry, one of the tip, one of the distinguishing features of generalized geometry is that it comes with two metrics. And so indeed, a second metric arises, but here it is defined, or it is, well, Spinner tells you what the second metric is. This is the most bizarre feature of SO77. Spinners very rarely give you metrics in seven dimensions, and in 7+7 dimensions they do. So representation theory summary, well, that's the most important message here, is that generic fermion of the standard model defines a metric in seven dimensions. This is the message to take home. It turns out that, well, representation theory is such that if you take the spinner of the standard model, put all these components together into a spinner of SO14, it defines a metric in seven dimensions. It's a mathematical fact. And as I said, this is a rare, extremely rare phenomenon. And actually, I don't know of any other case when this happens.
Do you know that metric is one of these special
Hollandian
metrics?
Oh, no. Special Hollandian metrics, they satisfy some differential equations.
That's more.
Yeah, so I'm not imposing any differential equations here. No, it's, at the moment, this is all kinematical, and we're just working in the tangent space to a point, so there are no equations here. But then, well, because standard model fermions define a metric, one is led to the speculation that what if gravity is about dynamics of that metric defined by spinners? This is the very natural thought that comes. At least, well, this is the thought that I'm considering. I mean, this is the line of thought that I'm investigating.
But this would mean that, let's say, under the symmetry breaking, you have the 4D metric plus the 3D metric. So what happens to the rest of the metric when you break down?
Well, there is a usual phenomenon of dimensional reduction, right?
Yeah, things can. Dimensional reduction, but yes. Spinners. But now, if you want to have the, what about the metric? It means that the metric you're getting is seven dimensional.
Yes, metric you're getting is seven dimensional, so one needs to further dimensional reduce. Well, yeah.
What's the meaning of the other three?
They are compactified in some way. But because I don't know how, and I don't know. Well, again, the spirit of this talk is that I'm describing a representation theory. This representation theory is familiar, but not in this context. And I'm suggesting that it may be relevant to the standard model. And you should make out of this representation theory what you like. I leave that up to you. I will show you in my last slide what I make up of, out of it. But again, interpretation is, you should interpret it in your own way. But I find that there is some exceptional geometric phenomena happening in 7+7D, and standard model fermions do tell you, well, do point you in this direction. So there may be something important here. Well, I can describe now, well, so let me start describing this. This is important, well, a bit more representation theory. This is the geometric construction of spinner representations, but actually I will not do much of it. I'll just tell you the main idea. So it turns out that spinners of SONN, of this split signature metric, they admit a beautiful explicit description in terms of differential forms. And actually this is probably the best explicit way of constructing spinner representations of any signature orthogonal group by appropriately complexifying and so on. So this is really the most powerful description of spinner representations. This is what mathematicians use when they talk about spinners. The idea is extremely simple. Well, we're going to realize our spinners as differential forms in half the dimension. So secretly, all spinners are differential forms. Well, how does it work? So let's introduce creation annihilation operators. We will be working in n dimensions. We'll have n creation operators. These will be the guys that act on differential forms and just wedge them with dxi, with the generators, with the one forms of which there is n. And let's introduce annihilation operators. This will be inserting or eating a factor of dx from your differential forms. It's clear that these satisfy anti-commutation relations. And so we get the Clifford algebra here. 7 plus 7 dimensional and split signature Lifapf algebra, because this metric is, you see that what gets paired is 7 gets paired to another 7, so this is a split signature metric. And of course, these things by themselves anti-commute, these things by themselves anti-commute, so you really have just split signature metric of the type kind of dxi dx tilde I. And that's our metric here. And then, oh, it's okay. I'm not going to use it too much. No. So we have realization of Clifford algebra. Clifford algebra acts in the space of differential forms in n dimensions. And then one finds that vial representations are those of fixed parity. So you either have odd degree or even degree differential forms. They are your vial representations. And this is very, very explicit. So well, here I have example, sorry, of SO22, which I will not cover. Then, well, but it's an exercise. Let me describe Dirac operator. This is another thing that can be done completely explicitly. So it's a Dirac operator in signature NN. So let me take, now my spinors are differential forms in N dimensions, but they depend on both x and x tilde coordinates, on both 7 plus 7. They don't just, so they are differential forms generated by dxi, not by dxi tilde, but they depend on both sets of coordinates. And then the Dirac operator is just, well, you differentiate with respect to xi's, and then you Clifford multiply with dxi, and you differentiate with respect to these coordinates with the other 7, and you Clifford multiply with dxi tilde, and the Clifford multiplication, this is just the wedge product, but this one is the insertion operator I talked about. So this Clifford multiplying this dxi tilde with something here eats a factor of dxi. And, well, this is a Dirac operator. This is correct Dirac operator. And then one can study its dimensional reduction. Again, here I have a couple of slides. Well, here, this is just an illustration, explicit calculation, that if you take R22 and do what I said, you realize spinors of R22 as differential forms in two dimensions, then, well, for example, unprimed spinors are objects of this type. You have zero forms, two forms, this is even. And prime spinors are general odd degree differential form. And then it's just an exercise to work out the Dirac operator as I explained it. This is this exterior derivative appropriately interpreted. You work it out and you see this is the usual Dirac operator as you know it. So of course it all works out. This is the usual Dirac operator in split signature. Here I'm talking about the split signature only. And then there is also a nice description of Weyl Lagrangian in this representation. So there is explicit description of the SONN invariant in a product on spinners. What you do, you take spinner, which is a differential form. You take the canonical anti-involution. So you simply replace all the occurrences of your dxi's. You put them in an opposite order. Then you wedge them together, and you restrict to the top form. It turns out that this inner product is SONN invariant. And then one can write down Weyl Lagrangian in this way. So these are differential forms in 7 dimensions. This is in 7 dimensions. D is that exterior derivative operator appropriately interpreted. You take this restriction to the top form, the invariant inner product, and you integrate over R and N. But then there are some simple facts that can be said about this Weyl Lagrangian. This Weyl Lagrangian only exists when n is 1 mod 4. So first of all, this is a Weyl Lagrangian, so it only exists when there are Weyl fermions. Therefore, this is okay. This is true for any n, but then Well, what I want to say is that in some cases, this Weyl Lagrangian, if you integrate by parts, you get a total divergence here instead of something non-trivial. So actually, this Lagrangian does not exist in any. So for example, this kinetic term will exist in 7-7 case, but will not exist for 5-5. Okay, and well, maybe I'll skip this slide. Well, actually, I have time for that slide. So let me explain another nice possibility that can be considered.
Yeah, just in fact,
yeah.
If you write it in the language of form, this Lagrangian becomes the Chern Simons functional.
It's kind of ADA. That's true. That's true. Yeah, it's some kind of, well, except.
Chern Simons become.
Except that, of course, this is the Dirac operator. This is not the exterior derivative.
Yeah, but
you have to appropriately interpret it. You have to. Yeah, yeah, it's like Chern Simons. Yeah, it's very natural
it's
construction.
Very interesting.
It's very, very natural construction. That's true. And so one can study a toy model. You take SO33, you take Lorentz group inside. What commutes with it is SO2, and one dimensionally reduces, one obtains single electrically charged Weyl fermion in 3+1. This is just one case which is non-trivial. You can write such Weyl Lagrangian for it. The next non-trivial case is SO77, and then you get, as I said, the Patti Salam bidimensional reduction. Okay, let me summarize. And I have one more slide on the possible future directions here. So standard model fermions point in the direction of some real form of SO14C. If you unify all the components, all the two component spinners present in the standard model, you are pointed to SO14. And then SO14 has some unique mathematical properties. SO14 is the largest orthogonal group that acts densely in its irreducible Weyl representation. It's bigger than its irreducible Weyl representation. Of unit spinners. It doesn't change the norm of the spinner, but otherwise it mixes all generic spinners. It's a transitive action in the space of generic spinners of unit, well, fixed norm, so to say. Even though there is no good notion of norm, I'll talk about that in a second. Then generic standard model fermion breaks SO14C to the subgroup G2 cos G2. And then the stabilizer of a generic spinner defines a metric in 7 dimensions. This is completely exceptional fact. I don't know of any other situation where a spinner would define a metric for you. Of the two possible real forms, this SO77 split one is much more beautiful because of what I said. It's easiest to describe spinner representations. The easiest link to generalized geometry. So mathematically, SO77 is much more beautiful than the other possible real form. I also described why spinners of SO77 are really differential forms in 7D. Dirac operator is a version of exterior derivative operator. Non-trivial Weyl Lagrangian exists only in 3-3 and 7-7 dimensions. And dimensional reduction to 3+1 gives you standard model fermion kinetic terms. And this is all just representation theory. And this is my last slide. So what can one make of it? Again, kind of the main, most puzzling and most interesting feature of all this is that non-zero standard model fermion field defines you a metric. So if fermionic field is non-zero for some reason, then it defines a metric. And a natural thought that arises in this context is that what if gravity is an effective field theory describing fluctuations of this metric? And then, well, this would be in direction of answering the question why metric is non-zero, because well, then you just need to find mechanism by which a spinner field is non-zero. This will tell you why metric is non-zero.
Just a question, when is that metric what's the condition of non-degeneracy?
Just that it's a generic spinner. It's in that generic orbit. There are some degenerate orbits Well, I think the answer to your question, the best answer is that it turns out that there is order 8 invariant constructed from the spinner. So if that is non-zero, then the metric is non-degenerate.
And it's the,
so then the critical point, okay. The critical point of that potential, then you might have a four-dimensional metric.
That I don't know.
Signature of that metric
7.0? Signature is, that metric can be, no, that metric doesn't need to be fixed signature. No, as I said, another possibility is 4.3, and it's even possible to get complex metrics this way, because one of the stabilizers is G2C. So complex metrics can also arise. So one has to really carefully understand what is happening.
You want to get
the 4D metric.
There are the critical locus, there is such a
critical locus of what? Well, but you don't.
You just don't say that this is the place where the metric is degenerate.
So no. Well, if this is zero,
yes.
Well, then metric is degenerate.
Yeah, that's
the, it's not a
prime.
Huh?
It's not the prime. Is that potential positive?
This potential. No, I don't think it's possible. It has a sign, and sign tells you some information about which orbit you're in.
Zero is not a critical point.
Zero is not a critical point, no.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and so something very, that appears very natural in this context, and this is something I'm thinking about now, is one can write a Lagrangian like this in 7 plus 7 dimensions. This is a Weyl Lagrangian. So this is the part that I already talked about. This is the part that reduces to kinetic terms of the standard model. And then there is this order 8 invariant. Well, actually having an invariant constructed from the Weyl spinner is again very rare. Because typically out of Weyl you cannot construct something that is invariant. This only happens in 4,4, because there in 4,4 your Weyl spinner is 8-dimensional. It's the same as vector. So there is an invariant in that case. And it also happens in 6,6, but then one cannot write anything like that. Because this is what I didn't explain. If you try to write down this Weyl Lagrangian, it's, you cannot attempt it at any n, but then if you, so your Weyl spinner is some fixed parity differential form. So for example, even in n dimensions. This is also even. So together they give you even, but remember this is a restriction on the top form, and d changes even to odd. So you, this Weyl Lagrangian only exists with n odd. You simply cannot write it with n even. And as I also said, this part, it turns out to be total derivative when n is not 1 mod 4. When it's 3 mod 4, this is total derivative. So this Lagrangian is pretty rare already. And having an invariant here, if you want an invariant, if you want to add something to make this non-trivial, this is even more rare. And so actually, a Lagrangian like this can be written, well, it really exists only in this particular situation, in 7 plus 7. If you keep enlarging the dimension, that, then something completely different starts happening. Your spinner orbits become of many different types. It simply becomes much more of a mess, the situation. I don't think anybody understands spinners beyond 14 dimensions. It just, well, this is, as I said, the situation with dimension up to 14 is nice, where the group acts transitively and the structure of orbits is nice. After 14 dimensions, it's a mess. So, well, this is pretty unique Lagrangian that can be written. And then, well, possible line of attack is to study solutions of this theory and try to understand.
I wonder what you think. So you basically have this kinetic term, and then if you restrict to spinners that all depend on the 4D subspace, then it breaks down to Patti's law, not all the way down. That's not enough.
Not all the way down to the standard model. No, it's just the Patti's law. Yes.
So to come back to the, I wonder if one restricted to, instead of restricting 4D, let's say if you restricted to spinners that were special in the sense that they gave rise to a metric that was of this special Halami type. Keep coming back to the special Halami type, because somehow if the whole structure is G2, it's,
but again,
it's something about
special Halami is a differential condition on your metric. it's some differential equation satisfied by it. So here, well.
To this
Lagrangian? Well, I know some solutions of this. Well, I know one solution of this Lagrangian, but it's a kind of a trivial one. It's related to something, seven dimensions and special holonomy. So there is one trivial solution where you simply assume that these fermion fields do not depend on x tilde coordinates. This becomes the usual exterior derivative, and then indeed there is a solution here of a familiar type from seven dimensions, of the type what you are suggesting.
So when you said,
but this is not an interesting solution.
You said the special holonomy gets differential conditions, and so that, are you saying that makes it hard to solve, or are you saying that somehow means?
I don't see why it's relevant. Yeah, special holonomy is you have a three form which is non-degenerate in seven dimensions, and it satisfies two differential equations. It's closed, and the four form that is constructed from it is closed as well. So that is what holonomy G2. So it's kind of potentially relevant, but not.
You say something very interesting. You say it's not interesting, but that's exactly the whole subject of general geometry. Is that suppose you put a section condition that these guys do not depend on x t, now you get differential equation.
Yes.
You think that this differential equation is exactly that thing?
No, it's not exactly that thing.
So
it's
maybe a linear differential equation on the side.
It's
what is the meaning of that?
Well, that has meaning. It's called nearly, or what's the right mathematical term? But, well, it's still interesting, but it's not what is called exceptional holonomy. There is a equation like this. So three forms of this type will be examples. They will satisfy this as well. This defines a metric in seven dimensions, but this metric it is not Ricci flat. It has constant Ricci scalar, and so it cannot be a metric of exceptional holonomy. But it's as close you can get to exceptional holonomy with non-zero Ricci scalar. Example of this metric, well, of this structure is S7. S7 is one example here. But, well, this solution is probably not interesting for what I would like to have. Because I would like to have some solution that tells me that I should compactify seven dimensions down to four dimensions. And I don't know if there are such solutions.
Just to say,
maybe we should finish. Yeah, I'm finished, so thank you.